Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. This week we'll be looking at the results of the presidential election in Finland and also the contested parliamentary election in Pakistan. And we'll be asking the big questions: do these results show that the country's status quo have been maintained? It's Sunday, the 18th of February, 2024.
I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify.
Not now.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
Crooked Joe Biden.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraine!
And joining me, as always, from the other side of the world is my co-host, Chern. Chern, how is everything going for you?
It's going good, thanks. It is February is, well, I can't believe we're nearly halfway through February already. And it does seem this year it seems to be much more paced out compared to a rush of elections we usually have, isn't it?
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, we did say last time we recorded that it's usually quite a quiet start to the year, but actually we've had some pretty consequential elections quite early on in 2024, which of course is going to be one of the biggest years for democracy in quite some time. And the two elections we'll be covering today is sort of a flying a little bit further under the radar on Finland's case, because it is the ceremonial president who is being elected, but nonetheless an interesting contest. And then on Pakistan's side, it is one of the largest elections in the world due to the Pakistan's population, but given how contested this result was, both following the election but also in the lead up to it, Chern, I think that has also been sort of flying under most election observers' radars as well, even though I think actually it's been a pretty consequential election.
When I think as well, don't forget, I think this is one of the rare years that I can think of where both Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh have all gone for elections, so what, in the space of 6 months? I certainly can't think of a time when all three countries have gone for elections. And in each way, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, and India, there are questions by international observers about some element about the electoral process in these countries, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Chen, just before we actually talk about the results of the Pakistan election, and we will be coming on to talk about Finland later in the podcast, so if you're interested in Finland, please stand by. But before we dive into the results, how the election operated, etc., Chen, I wanted to ask you first, were these elections free and fair? Because I think that is an asterisk we might have to place on the subsequent discussion.
I think it is the first question that comes to mind, and in some ways, I think the VDEM, which is one of those ratings agencies, has labeled Pakistan as an electoral autocracy. Now, on paper, it seems like Pakistan has there are some issues with the democratic process as well. Key among which is the fact that one of the key big political parties, certainly in the last 5 years, that is the PTI party, which is what is led by the former Pakistani Prime Minister and international cricketer Imran Khan, his party suffered a whole series of legal setbacks, including the fact that weeks before the election, Imran Khan was sentenced to jail term and banned from politics for 5 years. The court also banned PTI from using its electoral symbol, the cricket bat, therefore forcing its candidates to pick a different symbol and to stand as independents. And why do you why is removing the symbol so key? Is the fact that when there is the symbol, particularly in a country where 40% of the population is illiterate, was a clear signal about who that candidate was supporting. So there were definitely obstacles placed in the way of Imran Khan's PTI party in trying to get to try and get a majority in the legislature. Now, that is just the pre-election period. So therefore, said it made what we, if we assume these results to be a fair, accurate description, which we may not be, it is quite a remarkable result that has come out, isn't it?
I mean, Chen, that's, I think the symbol being banned, I think, is sort of the tip of the iceberg, because there's been pretty credible allegations by all accounts of electoral rigging, candidate arrests, campaign event disruption, rejection of nomination papers. Some PTI candidates were arrested and in prison. In fact, there was a strict order in place that any PTI-backed independent candidates couldn't discuss Imran Khan in television interviews. And also the PTI's voter helpline, info website and social media accounts were all banned for the duration of this election. And the news agencies were banned from linking PTI-backed candidates to PTI on national television, which meant that, again, it was just further making it difficult for people to make the association with these names listed on the ballot paper and PTI as well. So I think these things do need saying before we discuss the results. But Chen, you're absolutely right. Is that given all of this, given the context of how much PTI were seemingly shut out of this process, in fact, there was a de facto ban in place on the party, really, that they still won this election by getting the most seats in the declared count so far, with 93 seats out of the 266 single member constituencies on offer. With the PML, who is led by the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, recently returned from exile, who got 75 seats. And then in third place was the PPP, led by Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, who is the son of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. So some pretty totemic political dynasties on play in this election, and yet it was the PTI-backed independents who faced all of these obstacles who actually finished first in this election. So yeah, pretty consequential result and pretty remarkable given the circumstances.
Well, I should say as well is that the way I think it's important to talk about the Pakistani electoral system at this stage. So there are 266 single member constituencies, those are the results we read off. 41 seats have gone to independents, including 17 for the MQM, which is the Karachi-based party. But because there were 60 seats reserved for women that allocated proportion based on provincial results, 10 seats that are reserved for non-Muslims who are elected through proportional representation based on the number of overall general seats, you therefore need 169 seats in Pakistan to win a majority. So it's going to be a coalition government no matter what. And therefore, and the coalition government is very likely to be of Nawaz Sharif's PLN, the Pakistan People's Party, who actually had quite a good election at 54 seats up 11, and some smaller other parties. Not all 41 seats that went to smaller other parties, but the MQM said they will participate, and some smaller other parties said they'll participate as well. But Sam, before we break down these further into what does this possibly mean, I have to ask this caveat again. We talked about the pre-election. Can we believe these results, Sam?
Well, I mean, the PTI are claiming that actually they performed a lot better than 93. And I mean, I do think there is some credibility to those claims, because there was widespread electoral manipulation, allegedly, taking place in this election. And I think the fact that you would declare that 93 PTI-backed independent candidates won in an election where actually you were wanting to wipe PTI off the electoral map does suggest to me that actually maybe PTI did even better than that in reality. But perhaps we will never know. Perhaps these results are 100% accurate, but I think there's enough evidence to suggest that there is some distortion with these figures.
Well, I remember following the Asia Alex Twitter page on the day of the election itself, and unofficial results were putting the PTI at 111. So suddenly to be being falling down to 93 suggests that something might have happened. And one of the electoral commissions I've noticed resigned, saying that the Chief Justice and some of the electoral commissions directly engaged in electoral fraud. So There are some evidence to suggest that these results are not truly free and fair. There was a nationwide mobile phone blackout, which you touched upon as well. And Sam, it was remarkably slow, the results, I have to say. Despite the constitutional time limits, they did take their time counting these results. So I think that just added to the overall level of doubt and uncertainty and why we have to approach these results with an element of care, isn't it?
I mean, Chen, why don't we rewind the clock back? Because I think one of the interesting things about the Pakistan election is how we got here. Because 6 years ago, or just less than 6 years ago, Imran Khan's PTI party won the 2018 election. They were propped up by the Pakistan Muslim League and some independents to get a majority government. And Khan was sitting pretty comfortably as Pakistan's prime minister. But just over 5 years on, Khan is in prison. PTI are de facto banned from the election. And we've got these set of results. So how did we get here?
How do we get here? It's a long road. But to understand Pakistani politics, you have to understand that the one institution we haven't talked about and you cannot ignore in Pakistan is the military in Pakistan. They're incredibly influential, be it directly governing the country for half of its history through leaders such as Pervez Musharraf and Zia Al-Haq, for example, or indirectly, almost acting as a puppet master behind the shadows. And I think particularly in this post-Musharraf era, that's the role the military has been more comfortable playing, not necessarily directly putting the candidate there, but very much retaining influence behind the scenes. And the reason why the military is still so keen to intervene in Pakistani politics is that it's really keen to look after its own interests. It has a lot of economic and business interests in Pakistan. It is a big landowner as well. And it's keen to still have some influence over Pakistan's foreign and security policies that will enable it to best deliver its interests. So, for example, Imran Khan's rise in 2018 was very much fueled by a falling out between the chief of army and Nawaz Sharif throughout the latter half of his term from 2013 to 2018, because Nawaz Sharif wanted to forge better ties with India, and is within the Pakistani military's interest to keep ties with India a bit more frosty, because that way they could ensure their national security and law and order and their own interests could remain more paramount in an era when relations with India are more tense, for example. But what happened from 2018 to 2022 was that basically Imran Khan fell out with the military, particularly over the appointment of certain key positions within the Pakistani army. And as a result, it is often thought that the military engineered mechanisms within the PTI that caused several of its MPs to defect, to become independents, and to essentially bring about a no-confidence vote, which brought back Shahbaz Sharif, who was the brother of Nawaz Sharif, in power in 2022. So that's essentially what happened, and that has led to what is the situation going to this election.
I mean,
do you have anything else to add, Sam?
Yeah, I think, well, you covered that pretty eloquently. And I think the one thing that's important to understand since Shahbaz Sharif was put in place is that actually the PTI, despite Imran Khan's ousting, has had some pretty successful electoral results since then, because there was some provincial by-elections held in Punjab in 2022. The PTI won 15 of 20 seats there. They then, in October 2022, when there were National Assembly by-elections, won 7 of the 9 available seats there, and have maintained a pretty strong, I think, approval ratings in verifiable polls since Imran Khan's ousting. So it wasn't that there was some overwhelming wave of popular support that drove Imran Khan from power. And that's, I think, important to understand why we then ended up with this election, where the PTI, despite not being on the ballot paper, were able to do pretty well, because it did seem at the time like more of an institutional ousting of Imran Khan rather than a popular ousting of Imran Khan. And I think that's quite important to understand why they're still on the scene now in the strength that they appear to be after the elections of just under 2 weeks ago.
And I think as well, Sam, don't you think it's suspect as well that if you ask from the military's perspective, the best outcome is a weak civilian government, because it gives them the greatest leverage and the greatest influence. Isn't that exactly what we have here, Sam? It's a hung parliament situation. You have a coalition is needed to be formed between the Nawaz Sharif's PLM, who went backwards in his seat representation, and the PPP, the Pakistan People's Party. Now, traditionally in Pakistan, the PLN and the PPP are rivals to each other. Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif have rotated the prime ministership in the 90s, and it most prominently in the 90s and until they were fierce political foes. So it seems like all the ingredients are here for the military to maintain its maximum leverage, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons why we will not see either Nawaz Sharif or Bilawal Bhutto Zardari as prime minister is precisely because the parties would find it very difficult to work with each other under either of those figures. So currently, the working expectation is that Shahbaz Sharif will be the prime ministerial nominee once again, and basically will return the same six-party government that existed prior to this election. And I think it says everything, Chern, that both of those factions and some of the smaller parties going to this government are already talking about how long this government will last, whether it will see out the full term, and how any party can go about bringing it down. Which, I mean, if you're talking about those kind of things, the longevity of the government, before you've even formed the coalition, I think it says everything about the strength of it going forward.
And more importantly, who is going to be part of the government as well? Because the PPP wants to stay out of the government, but Nawaz Sharif wants it to share some of the burden, essentially, of government itself. Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, he was the foreign minister of Pakistan when Shahbaz Sharif was prime minister, for example. Mm. So I suspect that PLN, in its interest, will want to ensure that it gets the PPP to share the governing experience rather than let the PLM do it themselves.
I think, to be honest, Chern, I don't know whether you think this is a fair comment, but I think these elections have pretty much been an unmitigated disaster for the PML particularly, because Nawaz Sharif returned from exile in triumph. His disqualification from office was overturned by the Supreme Court. The expectation, I think, of the PML was that he would return to have a fourth term as prime minister. He would be able to put an end to the Imran Khan period of Pakistani politics. And what has happened? I mean,
there wasn't a level playing
field. Yeah, exactly. There wasn't a level playing field. The odds were stacked in their favour. And what has happened? The PML has actually gone backwards. They finished behind independent candidates who, in a country where 40% of the country was illiterate and would struggle to recognise them on a ballot paper. And you've had to nominate your brother because you just do not have the political strength to drive through a coalition led by yourself. So I think it has been a bit of a disaster for what the PML was hoping to achieve in this election. And for once in Nawaz Sharif's political career, the military were not against him, they were behind him. So everything about it, I think, has been a bit of a disaster for them.
Well, because, and we should say the reason why he was back here was that he was ousted a direct coup in 1999 by Pervez Musharraf, and he's also indirectly was ousted by Imran Khan with the military's help in 2018, Sam. So that leads to the big question: why? How did this happen?
I think it's a difficult question to answer why, but I think one of my big hunches is that I think quite a sizable amount of the population sort of saw through what was going on. And I think it comes back to what I said earlier about it wasn't a popular swell that removed Imran Khan from power. It did seem to come from the other political parties and the military. And I think it has been a difficult period since then trying to balance what the government looks like versus what the people wanted the government to look like. And this was the first electoral moment where people could try and reverse the removal of Imran Khan from power. And they remained campaigning. Yes, they didn't have the political symbol on the ballot paper. Yes, Imran Khan was facing his own personal legal troubles. But PTI was still out on the campaign trail. Up until very recently, Imran Khan has been doing some big rallies around the country. On the eve of his ouster, there was a widespread protest in Pakistan. And then an opinion poll, actually, again, asterisk, because we don't 100% know the reliability of some of these opinion polls, but 7 in 10 people said that they lacked confidence in the legitimacy and honesty of the electoral process. So when you've got those kind of numbers, I think you can sort of begin to understand why people, despite the unlevel playing field, still felt compelled and confident to go into the ballot box and vote in PTI-backed candidates. And that's why I think we've ended up here. And I think people ultimately rejected the idea that the Sharif family and the Bhutto family could dictate again what could happen in this election when they had a populist aspirational leader that they saw in Imran Khan.
Yeah, I think that is to be the case, in particular the youth of the Pakistani youth, you know, we were particularly discontented with the economic uncertainty, and they blame that on the rampant corruption in Pakistan and the fact that it's been political dynasties that dominate the Pakistan for most of its recent history as well. And voting for the PTI was also sending a message to the military establishment as well, and a message to the generals that people want change. Some other things that I found as well, Sam, was the fact that the PTI was particularly effective at using social media to get around the legal and institutional obstacles in place as well. And they also said that do not discount what happened to the Pakistan Democratic Movement, i.e. the last government that was when Shahbaz Sharif was the prime minister, and we had the PMLN and the PPP coalition government itself. What we saw in that only that 1 year in which they governed together, we saw a massive rate of inflation in 2022-2023. Pakistan was on the verge of default. It had a falling currency. It had very low foreign reserves, I think $24 billion, which is alarmingly low. And at the same time, what we did see was that the government led by Shahbaz Sharif, instead of tackling all these economic issues that were in place, they seemed more interested in removing the corruption case and the convictions against Nawaz Sharif and Shahbaz Sharif himself. Both the Sharif brothers were dogged by corruption allegations, and a lot of it was cleared up when Shahbaz Sharif was prime minister. So I think that's what fueled a lot of the discontent, is that, hey, you know, you see all of this economic uncertainty, but yet all you seem concerned with is clearing your own name in the courts. And this is where I think that could explain why it hit the PMLN particularly hard as well. Because the PMLN's base of factional support is the province of Punjab. And in this election, they were expected to take 80% of the seats in Punjab. In reality, they've only taken about 50%. And that extra overperformance, why did they underperform? Because the PTI overperformed in Punjab.
Yeah, and you actually saw Nawaz Sharif himself stood in two constituencies. One of them, he lost to the PTI, and the other has been heavily contested since election day, despite initial declarations that he won it. So it's, even for him personally, it's been a problem.
Exactly. And I think as well is that another thing you have to understand about Pakistan as well, and you saw this with Benazir in 2008 after Benazir Bhutto was assassinated, is that when a person or a family becomes oppressed in Pakistan, their support increases massively. We saw that after Benazir Bhutto was assassinated, often with the military not directly assassinating her, but having a hand in it, i.e. not providing adequate security. What happened in the 2008 general elections? It was convincingly won by the Pakistan People's Party. It has been the case in Pakistan that if you play the victim card, if you are seen as the victim, you are rewarded the next general election. And in this case, the PMLN was very much the victimizer, despite the fact that throughout different points in history, they were the victim. And the public, I think, clearly did not like that.
So, Chern, the question remains, what happens next? I mean, we've strongly hinted that we expect there to be this six-party coalition. We expect Shahbaz Sharif to return to the premiership. But given that this is a marriage of convenience, and given that Imran Khan's PTI candidates thus far have said that they will remain in the parliament, unlike following Imran Khan's ousting in 2022, what do we think the next period is going to look like in Pakistan politics? Do we expect Imran Khan to return to prominence? Do we expect the PTI to remain in parliament? And do we expect this coalition government to stay the course?
I think that's a That's a million-dollar question, isn't it? Because as we've seen, the military has been known throughout a term to change allegiances, isn't it? Because if, let's say, if a leader goes against his interests, it'll be willing to step in and to correct the situation and install somebody else who would bend to their interests. So it's really hard to answer this question when you have the question of the military involvement hanging over your head. But I definitely think in the short term, we will see some kind of government arrangement. I suspect the PPP will go into government itself, but it will extract a high price on that, largely because the parties are much more equal in terms of their support. The PAMLN did very badly, as I say, in Punjab, whereas the PPP did a lot better in its stronghold of Sindh, which is where the Bhutto family is from. So I think the price that the Sharif brothers will have to pay is a lot higher this time around. And we're not necessarily guaranteeing that this government could last 5 years, i.e. it's likely to be the case that this is the military's best interest. As I said earlier, we are getting to the situation where there's a weak civilian government and where they can exercise maximum leverage. But Sam, a final thought from me, and I'm keen to hear your thoughts as well, is I can't help but look at the situation in Pakistan and think of the situation in Thailand when we did the elections last year, where we had an upstart political party seemingly coming out of nowhere, had obstacles put in place, the Future Forward Party and Peter Lim John Rat, and they doing remarkably well in their elections. And in the end, thanks to the establishment, in the case of Thailand, more overtly through its constitution, we get a government in which it's very much all rivals having to put aside the differences in order to keep what is often seen as the anti-establishment party out, isn't it?
Yeah, I think those are interesting parallels. I think one of the key differences, though, is that in Thailand's case, it was a party who's been perennially shut out of government. And in Pakistan's case, of course, Imran Khan did spend nearly 4 years as Prime Minister of Pakistan. So I think that is one of the key differences. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The military involvement is pretty similar, and also the institutional levers being pulled to try and shut that party out of government is very similar as well. I think the one key difference, and this is another part of the what's next question, is international response to these elections, because I think the international community would be pretty happy if the Move Forward party were to be in power in Thailand, whereas actually the international community seem, on the whole, more favourable towards the more traditional Sharif Bhutto influence in Pakistan than they would towards Imran Khan. I think the US certainly see Sharif as a more reliable ally than Imran Khan, particularly in regional access. And also Nawaz Sharif, I think, is seen as a figure more likely to help calm relations with India over Kashmir than Imran Khan was. So I think there is some international differences between these two elections in Thailand and Pakistan.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. In the next half of this podcast, we'll be moving across to the top of the world, and it must seem that way for former Prime Minister Alexander Stubb of the National Coalition Party, as he's the new president-elect of Finland. He's set to be sworn in as the new Finland president on March the 1st. He beat the former foreign minister Pekka Haavisto, who was an independent but supported by the Green League, 51.6% to 48.4%. This is after both men advanced from the first round, which was held a couple of weeks beforehand, with Stubb also leading the first round, 27.2% in the first round, compared to Haavisto's 25.8%. And I think a nod is to that this Finnish elections, if you were a neutral voter, you had a lot of the participants that were representing political parties were incredibly well credentialed. Both men beat the speaker, the former leader of the Finns party, and the current speaker of parliament, Jussi Halla-aho, Olli Rehn, who was a former governor of the Finnish Central Bank, Li Andersson, who was a Left Alliance leader and former education minister, Jutta Jappelin, who was a Social Democratic Party leader, former finance minister, and Finland's current EU commissioner, and Sari Isehaa, who is the agriculture minister, to the first round. So they beat a quite a well-starred field to become the president of Finland. And I think that does speak, Sam, before we dive into the reactions for this, that the Finnish president, because of what we see in Finland's pivotal role as literally the next door neighbor of Russia, it has now been seen in a very important light, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, I did say at the top of this podcast, Chern, that it was a largely ceremonial role being elected in Finland. But of course, given that Finland joined NATO last year, and given that we're about to come up to the 2-year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is on Finland's doorstep, actually the president of Finland is a much more important role because of their military capacity, because they are the commander-in-chief of the Finnish Defence Forces, which has largely been ceremonial for the majority of Finland's post-war history. But of course, Finland now choosing to join NATO within the last 12 months, you now have slightly more influence on the Finnish presidency. And I think that's probably the reason why we've seen a lot of high-profile figures, particularly Alexander Stubb, the now president-elect of Finland, had left Finnish politics altogether. He'd retired from frontline Finnish politics, but this role brought him back to the front line because of its increased prominence, and now he will be taking on that role in just under a fortnight.
And in fact, he actually said what brought him back to Finnish politics, it was Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. So a bit about Alexander Stubb. So I think it can be safe to say, Sam, would you not agree he's been the comeback kid of Finnish politics? He became foreign minister to his own surprise, he said, in 2008. He was praised for his high energy approach to politics, but he was criticized during his time in government, particularly as foreign minister, for his occasional hasty statements, such as swearing at a meeting of the Nordic Council of Nations, for example. He became prime minister in 2014, but failed to reverse the National Coalition Party's slump in popularity and convincingly lost the 2015 Finnish parliamentary elections. He subsequently became finance minister, but then left Finnish politics. So, Sam, given all this, was this result a surprise to you?
I think following the first round, it wasn't particularly surprising. And there's a few reasons for that. One, of course, Alexander Stubb did finish first place in that first round. And most of the time, the first place finisher in the first round retains enough support to head into first place in the second round. And I think crucially, the other thing is that because Alexander Stubb hails from the more centre-right of Finnish politics and has been pretty hawkish on Russia, he was much better positioned to hoover up the quite large, in the grand scheme of things, first-round support of Jussi Halla-Aho. The Finns Party, of course, have been growing in prominence in Finland. We covered them when we covered the Finnish parliamentary election, which saw Petteri Orpo win on behalf of his National Coalition Party. So I think this election was set up to be more catered towards someone of the centre-right, just because of where the populist right vote is quite sizable and where it could possibly go, because Pekka Haavisto, for numerous reasons, was not well positioned to pick up support from the Finns Party. But Alexander Stubb, particularly in his comments he was making about Russia and Ukraine, was much better positioned to pick up that support. And I think that's ultimately why he was able to win this election. But Chern, one thing I did want to say about this election in sum is that I think it's a good news story, to be honest, because very rarely nowadays do we actually talk about elections where the candidates, one, respect each other, two, manage to have some pretty civil debates on pretty consequential issues, but then three, be able to honestly answer a question to say, you know what, even if you win this election, I think Finland's in pretty safe hands. And I think that's a pretty respectful election to be talking about in the grand scheme of things, especially what's coming up in the UK and the US later this year, which I think is going to be a less than respectful contest. I think to be able to have a debate on numerous pretty seismic issues for a country like Finland, particularly in its geographic position currently, I think for you to then retain that level of respect going through to the end of the contest, you know what? I think that's good news and worth a shout out.
Well, I want to talk about I want to talk a little bit about what the differences were, because there were some subtle differences between Alexander Stubb and Pekka Haavisto. But you're right. I think largely on the broad themes of foreign policy and defense policy, they are largely they largely had the same position, certainly towards Russia, towards NATO, towards Europe, for example, as well. I just want to talk about some of the other reasons why Alexander Stubb could have won. And I did a bit of math, Sam. If you just look at the first round results and you take away all the other candidates, so apart from Alexander Stubb and Pekka Vasto, in the first round, between these two men, Alexander Stubb won 51.3% of the vote. So actually, what it seems to be is that in the second round, yes, it seems to be roughly the same kind of the other candidates, their votes split almost 50-50, potentially slight bias in favor of Alexander Stubb because he got 51.6% overall. But I think what it does say as well is that it's in recognition of the fact that both candidates really are roughly the same. So
wasn't it, Chern, the closest Finnish presidential election in history since they were elected using direct elections?
Precisely. And therefore, you have to think about what helped Alexander Stubb get into such a strong position in the first place. And I think I'd like to point out three factors. The first is you cannot ignore the popularity, the outgoing presence, Sauli Niinistö, who is also from the National Coalition Party, and that might have had coattail effects to help Alexander Stubb. In Sauli Niinistö in 2018 became the first Finnish president to have won outright in the first round without needing to go to the second round. And since 2021, his approval ratings have been over 90%. In fact, he had to turn down and say a petition to try and get him to run for a third term because he simply was not interested in it. So I think the coattails of the outgoing president cannot be ignored here. Secondly, we need to also take a look at how Alexander Stubb ran this campaign compared to his previous elections. You talked about the demeanor, the more thoughtful demeanor. I think that was a good backdrop, particularly to how people perceived Alexander Stubb previously. The swearing, for example, to now openly acknowledge his rivals and to pay respect to him. I think that's also very interesting and appeal in the context of a Finland that has been riven by a series of racism scandals, largely involving Finns party government ministers, and more recently over strikes over work conditions and wages that paralyzed public services. So I think a more respectful tone by Alexander Stubb helped as well. And thirdly, turnout, I think, is also something that is interesting to note as well. Turnout in the second round was 5 percentage points down on the first round as well. And Alexander Stubb's support, as is typical of a centre-right party, is more concentrated amongst pensioners, whereas Pekka Vasso's support was more concentrated in lower propensity voters, such as young people and in urban areas as well. So that drop of that 5 percentage points, I think, sealed the coffin for Pekka Vasso's third attempt to run at the presidency. Your thoughts on all three things, Sam?
Yeah, actually, all three things were things I had written down as potential reasons for Alexander Stubb's victory in this election. And I think you've got to remember that this election was very close. We saw the Finnish parliamentary election was immensely close as well. So we've got a situation currently in Finland where voters haven't fully made up their mind which ideological direction they want to go in. And there are now three really available ideological directions. One is the centre-right, the National Coalition Party, the centre-left, the Social Democrats, Sanna Marin's former party, and then you've got the more populist right-wing option. Those are the three headline options, the Finns party. So it's very small things that can swing these elections. And I think all three of the ones you mentioned, Chern, would help contribute towards that. And also, fundamentally, Alexander Stubb is from the political party of the current Prime Minister Petteri Orpo, and the National Coalition still leads in national opinion polls. So the environment is one where the National Coalition is narrowly favoured as the party of government, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if that filters down to the presidential election as well, when you see broadly the main candidates in this election were backed by the prominent political parties, because Pekka Haavisto was backed by the Centre Party, whereas actually in recent years in Finland, quite a lot of the mainstream presidential candidates have actually been non-aligned. So that's one of the differences in this election as well. And I think the only other thing, Chern, is that I said it at the beginning, but I do think the much easier ability of Finn's party voters to transfer to Alexander Stubb was ultimately one thing that swung it as well, because the Finn's party coalition in Finland is the third strongest coalition available. And if you can get a majority of that vote to swing in your corner, you're then at a bigger advantage compared to the other parties who are just scrambling to gain support from every other candidate available. But really, the Finns party supporters were either not going to vote or going to vote for Alexander Stubb, I think, in the majority of cases. And given that turnout drop between the first and second round was fairly negligible, I think you can safely assume that most of those voters from Hossi Halla-aho went into Alexander Stubb's camp when this second round came around.
I will say that I think if this is the first election since 2000, with the election of Finland's first female president, Tarja Halonen, that the prime minister and the president was elected from the same party as that of the prime minister. So it's been a while since that has happened. I think that's something to note as well. But I agree with your points there as well, in terms of some of the other factors that could have contributed to this outcome that we see here. I think the Finns party, you're right, they're much more likely to back them. And I think at 20%, it's still quite a reasonable, respectable showing, actually, by the Finns party as well. I will say as well, I noticed matches the vote share they got in the last parliamentary elections as well. So I suspect of all the Finns party people who voted in the parliamentary elections, they probably voted for UC Halla-aho in the presidential elections, compared to some of the other parties, such as the Social Democrats in particular, I'm looking at, because the candidate for Jutta Jypulin got only about 4% of the vote, significantly underperforming the parliamentary election performance of the Social Democrats. So I think the Finns party is probably the party that held most of its supporters from the parliamentary election. Would you not agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the key reasons why, yes, this election was very close, and we've got to keep looking through that prism of this was very competitive down to the very end, but we've got to look at the little things that swung it marginally in Alexander Stubb's favour as we approached election day.
So if we want to talk about little things that could have swung it, do you think there could have been little things in terms of policy differences? I know the broad strokes of the foreign and defense policies are roughly the same. But Sam, in your research, do you find any small differences between the candidates that could have swayed the outcome?
Yeah, I mean, there were minor differences. You said that broadly they agreed on Russia, but there were minor differences on Russia. Alexander Stubb was certainly the more hawkish of the two. And again, particularly on that the Finns party collection of voters, it was Alexander Stubb who supported expressly the removal of citizenship from people with dual Finnish Russian nationality, which was in line with Halla-aho's position going into this election as well, whereas Haavisto was the one expressing concern about the rhetoric of asylum seekers and nationalities. So that was a slight difference, which I think helped Stubb hoover up those Finns party voters. And then you also had widespread strikes going on in Finland, as there are across a lot of the Western world at the moment. And that was a key area of difference, because Alexander Stubb was more pro-market. He wanted the market to resolve itself. He wanted it to be a discussion between the employers and the employees. Whereas Haavisto was much on the side of bringing the parties together to negotiate between the employee, the employer and the government. And I think perhaps those policy differences, when you're a citizen just experiencing the impact of strikes rather than being a striker yourself, maybe you're more on the side of they just need to sort this out. And that's Alexander Stubb's position. So perhaps those little things could make a difference. And nuclear as well. You saw Alexander Stubb pro-nuclear weapons being stored in Finland, Haavisto not. And in the context of overwhelming Finnish support to enter NATO and the Russia-Ukraine conflict, perhaps Alexander Stubb being much more open to other NATO allies storing weapons within Finland and Ireland, perhaps you would see a little trickle of support in that direction as well. He was much more hawkish on general Finnish defence.
Absolutely. I think the hawkish element, you point on nuclear weapons as well. Pekka Haavisto from the Greens, so obviously he would take a different point of view on nuclear weapons itself. on the situation of Russia, you talked about Ireland. Alexander Stubb was in favor of allowing a Finnish military presence on the archipelago itself, which will reverse a policy that's been in place since 1856. So I think that does show him how hawkish, he's slightly relatively more hawkish. The final one I did pick up that I think it is important to talk about is that Pekka Haavisto, in the days leading up to this, to the second round in particular, criticized journalists, including from those of the national broadcaster, of triggering, in his words, triggering discussions around the fact that if he was successfully elected president, he would be the first Green and more prominently the first gay elected president in Finnish history. And there was some thought that and the University of Helsinki did a poll around it, which found a third of voters could not vote for Pekka Haavisto because of his sexuality as well. Small little things, I think, like that could help explain the outcome.
Well, Chen, two very interesting, albeit different, elections to talk about today.
Indeed. And we often end with a question of, so what are your takeaways from any of these two elections? Do you have any, Sam? I think this one could be a bit hard about to draw, but when you look at these two elections, what do you think?
I mean, the opening question that we asked was, do these results show that the country's status quo has been maintained? I think both of them kind of do, because Alexander Stubb in many ways is continuity Salinisto, and then Pakistan has continuity chaos, because you've still got support for Imran Khan pretty high on the agenda in Pakistan, and yet it's the second and third placed candidates who will be forming the next government in all likelihood, and we'll just have pretty much the exact same government going into the election, despite the fact that the PTI-backed candidates were the ones who were the most successful. So, yes, you do see that the status quo has been maintained in both these elections, albeit for very different reasons and in wildly different contexts.
And I think as well, something to note as well from my point of view, I think it does show you that never write people off. Comebacks can happen. We saw a comeback that has happened in Finland with Alexander Stubb as well. We saw a comeback with Nawaz Sharif, or well, the thought of the comeback. So I would say to Imran Khan, who's currently sitting in jail, that it does show that comeback kids are plentiful, more than just Bill Clinton in the New Hampshire primary.
Well, Chen, it's been fascinating, but I think that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next time when we'll be reviewing the general election results from Indonesia, and we'll be also looking ahead to the parliamentary elections in Portugal, another fascinating political story. And as always, we'll continue to bring you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at @ballot_talk. And please do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. You can also email any feedback or comments to ballottotalkabout@gmail.com. My name is Sam, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.